and welcome to the fifth episode of the Totally Football Show presents Zonal Marking. This, as I'm sure you're aware now, is our six-part summer series to coincide with the release of Zonal Marking, the book written by Michael Cox. Michael, what's the full title of that book?
It is Zonal Marking, the making of modern European football.
What's it about outside of the realms of the making and the modern and the football?
Kind of a mini history of the European game, focusing on seven different countries. Holland, Italy, France, Portugal, Spain, Germany, and a little bit about England.
I like the way it bounces from one to another. There's a smooth transition. There's a narrative arc.
Good, I'm pleased to hear that. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I liked it. Today, we're talking Spain, and we're joined by the Totally Football Show Spanish correspondent, Alvaro Romeo. All right.
Buenos días. How are you?
Spain, Alvaro. Ahead of 2008, this is always really funny for younger football fans who just have this idea of Spain as mostly this all-conquering total football unit thing. But before 2008, I mean, Spain internationally were basically a misbegotten collection of serial bottlers, weren't they?
Yes, they were. And I have to say that there was one expression repeated along media and among supporters as well, which was the curse of the quarterfinals, because Spain never made it through the quarterfinals, or at least there was a space of 20 years in which they couldn't make it any farther than that. It was a team of underachievers. They won the European Under-21 in 1986, in 1998, the Olympic gold medal in 1992, the Under-20 World Cup in 1999, but there was no crystallization of that in the senior national team. And there was also some defeats with a sense of aggravation, like, for example, in World Cup 1994, when Tassotti broke Luis Enrique's nose, in World Cup 2002, when Argandur, a referee, cancelled few goals from Spain that should have counted.
Morientes! No! No! Flag was up. The whistle had gone. I think it was out of play. Another great run by Joachim. Oh,
not so sure about that, but there goes the flag.
The flag's up though, Peter, isn't it?
There was this disproportion between what the Spanish clubs were doing and what the Spanish national team was doing. And also the Spanish national team sometimes was showing how good they could be. For example, Spain has never lost a World Cup qualifying game at home, which is something really impressive that very few national teams have done. So there was this question of what do we do now? How can Spain become competitive? To the point that when Luis Aragonés was appointed as a Spanish manager in 2004, he called for a big sit-down between the Spanish Federation, the players, and also Spanish media to know what we wanted Spanish football to be, how we could rebrand it. And I think that from those years between 2004 and 2008, Michael in his book explains that that is the era when probably the Portuguese style became trendy. Spain was also in the making of the style that they later in 2008 they started implementing on the game.
What do you think was going wrong before? Because there's obviously no shortage of talent. No shortage of sort of natural resource of players coming through the ranks. But it always felt like an identity problem. There wasn't a clear idea of what a Spanish national team should be, partly out of you have a complicated national history there with so many different identities. Was that at the root of it?
There was a bit of that. Then there was a little bit of how we can put an excuse on our poor performance. So there was always a scapegoat. I remember in 1994 it was Julio Salinas for not being able to score a one-on-one with Gianluca Pagliuca.
A pesar que Salinas se mueve hacia una otra banda y va el balón hacia Salinas. Pagliuca. Caminero ha recuperado el balón. Caminero. No. Qué pena.
Then in 1998, it was the national team manager Javier Clemente, because he was building a really rock-solid team, but he wasn't letting the talent flourish. Then from 2000 until 2006, probably Raúl was in some sort of way the scapegoat. Not only Raúl, but also all the derivations that came from him, like which players couldn't play because Raúl was playing, or which players weren't up to the level that Raúl was raising in the Spanish national team. So I think that there was the talent, but there was not a clear idea of what Spain wanted to be. Hence, the sit-down of Spanish football that Luis Aragonés proposed back in 2004. Just to think about what we wanted to be, because some other countries, they had found a way sometimes, but Spain hadn't found it yet.
And Michael, you actually point to Raul as being one of the pivotal moments where the team sort of clicks into gear, the removal of Raul.
Yeah, when he dropped out of the national side, it was hugely controversial at the time. He'd been their leader for the best part of a decade, really. And it was interesting to research, go back and look at some of the stories. I mean, when Aragonés dropped him, he had pro-Raul graffiti on his outside of his house. They went down to play a friendly at Malaga, got the train, arrived at the train station. Loads of people there with Raul shirts singing about how he should be reinstated. But they moved on and they played a slightly different style of football and never looked back. And it's interesting when you look at how Spain transformed to be successful after Raul. Germany did a similar thing after Michael Ballack dropped out. Maybe England with Wayne Rooney. But I think sometimes at international level, when you're based so much around one player, that's not always the best recipe for a successful team.
So with Raul gone, what kind of 11 are we looking at generally in that team?
Well, they had obviously two other very good forwards in Torres and Villa, who got along well off the pitch. On the pitch, they often combine well, although the story of the next 4 years is really about Spain playing fewer and fewer strikers. But I think without Raul, obviously the department of the side that takes over is the midfield. And, you know, the dominance of Xavi and Iniesta, you know, at a time when they hadn't yet reached that kind of status at Barcelona. You know, they won Euro 2008 just before Guardiola had taken charge of those players. They really stamped their authority on the tournament.
And of course, just behind them, you've got Marcos Senna, not a natural Spaniard, but actually became quite pivotal in the fact that he allowed everyone else to play.
Well, he could do plenty of things. That was the thing about Marcos Senna and apparently effortless, which made him look like a more silky player than he actually was. I think that Marcos Senna was favoured and benefited as well by the fact that Ronald Koeman burned the bridge with few Valencia players, Cañizares, Albelda and Angulo. And the three of them could have been capped by Spain if Luis Aragonés wanted. And David Albelda was meant to be probably the Spanish holding midfielder. David Albelda didn't play for the end of the 2007-2008 season, or at least for the final third of that season. And then Marcos Senna was obviously the most obvious replacement. And he did a great job. And he married up really well with all the Spanish little stars in the making. Xavi was already a really good player, but Iniesta, Silva, Cazorla, Fabregas were players that they still needed to go a step further. And I think that Marcos Senna was the perfect man to make them all click.
And what about the defence?
The key defender really was Carlos Puyol, and there was Marchena at the back. This was when Sergio Ramos was still right back. And you had Capdevila, who was often, I'd say, quite underrated because he wasn't one of the bigger sides. And then, of course, Iker Casillas in goal. Spent a great strength and depth throughout this period with Reina and Valdes coming to the fore later on. And they always pretty much stuck by Casillas. He wasn't always performing best at club level. I think he sometimes had a couple of seasons where Pepe Reina, for example, was doing better. But he was, you know, crucial off the pitch as well, and as well as, you know, being a very good goalkeeper on it.
You ran a competition on Twitter back when the book came out asking for most underrated European players. And Capdevila, just springing into my head, probably should have said him, not Tony Hibbert. What kind of football team are this Spanish team, though? What kind of style of football do they play?
At the minute, they play something absolutely different. They go for at least more of a vertigo-type football with Luis Enrique, even though there are some patterns that still stay from the 2012 squad. But I think that in 2006, that was still to be determined. And I remember that Luis Aragonés, in that bracket between 2006 and 2008, he said something that at the moment was quite controversial. He said that the Spanish players didn't have the physical condition to compete with the likes of Germany or Italy or teams like this. That was misunderstood. It was understood as an excuse from Luis Aragonés. But what he actually was implying was that Spain had to favour the best players they had. In that case, they were the short ones. Silva started playing with Aragonés in 2006. Iniesta and Xavi became important. Santi Cazorla started making it to the squad as well. And Luis Aragonés, at some point, he said that if he couldn't take this Spanish team to the later stages of a tournament or win a tournament, he was a fiasco himself, because he knew that he had a lot of talent in his hands and he just needed them to click. So in 2006, World Cup 2006, I'm sorry if I go back too far, before that World Cup, Luis Aragonés said that if Spain didn't make it to the semifinals, he will resign. Well, actually, Spain didn't make it to the semifinals in World Cup 2006, but he stayed. And the only reason why is because he had a tremendous faith in these players, and he knew the mistakes that he had done in 2006, like, for example, capping Raúl, capping Albelda, and some players from the old school, that they weren't bringing anything new to the Spanish team, and they weren't bringing anything to the new idea he had of the whole Spain. I think that from that point, and from the moment that Spain beat England in Manchester, when the tiki-taka style proved that it was a great resource and tool to win a game, from that point, Spain was already ready to win a European Championship.
He turned in well via. Oh, and Silva didn't get his head to that. Iniesta might fire one, and he has. And Spain take the lead. Number 16, Iniesta, only on for a few minutes.
And he was an interesting choice as manager, wasn't he?
Well, I mean, for a manager that oversaw the complete revolution of Spanish football in terms of the technical style, he wasn't always considered like that. He was kind of considered a bit of an old school, back to basics manager. You look at his successes previously in his career with Atletico Madrid, for example. They're quite defensive sides, and he'd famously had a bit of a rant about Spain trying to play too technically a few years before he came manager, saying that they needed to get back to the old physical, furious Spanish style that had, you know, epitomised the football in previous years. So I think he was a pragmatist more than he wasn't committed to defensive football. He was a pragmatist. And the fact that he was a pragmatist and found himself with lots of technical players meant actually he had the opportunity here to make something first and foremost successful. And then, you know, after they had proved that success, then he could say, well, I hope they continue in this style for years to come.
And he certainly managed that. 2008 European Championships comes up. No one is really tipping Spain. They're doing the usual thing at this stage. You know, all international tournament predictions are Spain, talented, but will fall apart. Germany will be efficient, and so on and so forth. So Spain get through the group stage fairly comfortably, and then they just about struggle past Italy with a penalty shootout win after a goalless draw. But this is hailed as a major victory, isn't it, Alvaro?
It is, and I believe that this is the turning point. In the same way that beating England in Manchester was some sort of the proof that that was the way and the path for Spain, this was definitely the turning point in Spanish recent history, because I remember that the Spanish journalist Enrique González described playing against that Italy like having a fight in the dark cul-de-sac, and normally Italy won it because they knew how to take advantage of every single adversity. And the Spanish national team had to prove that, obviously. And as the game progressed, we were entering in the Italian territory. It was an extra time, then there was a penalty shootout, and we all know that Italy knows how to handle that very well, or at least they knew at the time, because they knew Italy is a different team. But Spain made it, and they qualified for the first semi-final since 1984.
Vamos, es! Vamos, es! Hay que marcar!
Spain had a lot of depth in that game. This is something that I find quite remarkable now when I look at the papers and the team sheets and all that. Xavi, Iniesta had Cazorla and Fabregas as replacements in Spain. Villa and Torres could play in the Spanish national team, but Dani Huiza was a really good striker who had been that year the Spanish top scorer as well. So there was not only a really good lineup, but also a fantastic, fantastic squad. And the fact that Fabregas, coming out from the bench most of the time, played eventually more minutes in that Euro Cup than Xavi Hernández tells you a lot. The players who scored the penalties were Cazorla, 23 years old, Cesc Fabregas, 21, David Villa, 26 years old. So they were young and they proved that they were ready for any challenge. And that was the beginning of something really promising. And also the fact that they managed to dry out Italy completely. Italy didn't score any goal. And in fact, that was going to be a trend in the Spanish national team. When they won the Euro in 2008, in 2010, when they won the World Cup, and in 2012, when they won the European Championship, Spain didn't concede any goal in the knockout stages. We talk about for all the talk we do about the tiki-taka, we also have to say that defensively, that system was great.
Then they come through to the semi-finals against Russia. Now, this was the first international tournament I ever covered as a journalist working for the new paper in Singapore. And I will always remember this game because I saw Carlsberg, the sponsors, had had a competition. It was like a continent-wide competition, and a lucky winner and their friend would basically be taken to every game of their nation's tournament and just given free Carlsberg, as much as they could possibly take. And a Russian guy won it, a big Russian guy. I don't know if you've ever been in a drinking contest with a Russian. It's a really bad idea. And these two, they'd won, and in the first group game, they were absolutely mortal. Second group game, absolutely mortal. And the poor PR women taking them around from one place to another, all they were saying to themselves was, it's all right, they're Russian, they won't be in the tournament very long. By the semi-finals, I've never seen two human beings drunker than these two, just being led gently around the stadiums. I can't actually remember what happened in the game. That's all that sticks for me.
Well, probably that man either. But yeah, Spain won 3-0. It was 0-0 at the halftime. And then after the halftime, I think that there was this Spain team unfolding their wings. And there were goals from, first of all, Xavi, then Dani Guiza, and then David Silva.
He can either go on himself or he can lay the ball across. It might be three. It's sumptuous. It's beautiful football. And Silva has surely sent Spain into the final now.
I think that Racing had a decent team. And Luis Aragonés was very worried about that. He loved Pavlyuchenko. He said that he was a really dangerous player. And in fact, one of the best saves I've personally seen in my life has been one from Casillas to Pavlyuchenko in that game. They had beaten Netherlands in the quarterfinals in Russia, and there was a sense as well of revenge from Spain towards Gus Hiddink, because he was the manager who took South Korea to the World Cup semi-finals in 2002, knocking out Spain from the tournament.
So, an unimpeachable victory that was not odd in any way.
No, I think that Spain did probably their best game in the tournament that day, and the 3-0 was one of those victories that will stay in the Spanish museum.
And then it comes to the final and an enforced change of system. It's not ideal before a final.
No, it's not. Although, I mean, so this is David Villa, who limps off midway through the semi-final, or actually in the first half of the semi-final, and Fabregas comes on. And, you know, after that semi-final, Aragonés is asked about how they're going to replace him. And he says, well, actually, tonight we play better just with one striker. And that's almost the moment of realisation. And after that, it's quite rare that they play two up front. Sometimes they try and accommodate two by having Torres up front and Villa on the left in the next World Cup, but they basically changed to a one-striker system. And I think Fabregas is maybe the most underrated player in terms of Spain's successes, because, as Alvaro says, he wasn't really starting, but he often, well, in both European Championship victories, he came into the side, basically played his way into the side as a substitute, and they basically couldn't leave him out. And then in the World Cup as well, he's only a substitute, but he assists the winner. He's not considered up there with Xavi and Iniesta as a real symbol of this side, but I think had a huge contribution.
And they're up against Germany, who are 2 years on from finishing in the semi-finals in the World Cup in their own country. We're starting to see the embryonic development of the new-look German team. And I've got to be honest, I was at this game as well, and I was convinced Germany would win.
Yeah, I mean, it was maybe not a great demonstration of Spain's passing football at times, because I think it was, you know, as finals are, it's often a little bit defensive, a little bit cagey. But they go ahead through that really clever finish from Torres from Xavi's pass. And the interesting thing, looking back at this, is in the last 15, 20 minutes, Spain bring on a couple of substitutes. Xabi Alonso is one of them. But they don't just try and kill the game. They actually keep on going for a second goal and a third goal and a fourth goal. And I think that maybe wouldn't have happened in later tournaments, when Spain become very wily, very efficient at basically shutting down games. But here they really wanted to score more goals. And yeah, that was almost quite a surprise to kind of revisit that.
And there is also an element of taking out the pressure from the players, from Luis Aragonés. Before the game, Luis Aragonés, he couldn't pronounce Michael Ballack's name in the locker room, so the players were just laughing about it. And Luis Aragonés, he realized that they were laughing about the way he was pronouncing Michael Ballack's name. So in the tunnel before the game, Luis Aragonés was talking to the players, and Michael Ballack was over there, and he was talking to Michael Ballack and calling him Wallace in front of all the players, and the players were laughing about it. So I think that Luis Aragonés was also very clever when it came to that, to those moments because he knew that the best way for the players to come out to the final and play in Vienna, it was them being happy and them having fun. And he managed to get that. Of course, then there was a 90-minute game, and as Michael said, I mean, it was a bit cagey and all that. But I think that the element of Luis Aragonés taking away pressure from players cannot go unnoticed either.
And how did it feel for you? I mean, forget being a journalist. Yeah. As a Spanish football fan, to finally have a team that lives up to their potential.
It's strange because I think that the biggest happiness for me came when Spain beat Italy in the quarterfinals. And I think that it happens like this for every football fan. Your favourite ever game is not the key game, but another one that people will end up forgetting about, but you don't. But I think that I remember as a Basque person, I remember that the Spanish games were normally not shown on bars. Not many people were talking in Bilbao about the Spanish national team because, you know, we had the Basque problem and all that, the terrorism at the time. And I remember that after Spain won the Euro Cup, I went out with a friend just to have a beer, and we couldn't believe that there were some drivers just honking their cars. And in one of the main Bilbao squares, Plaza Moyúa, there was a huge party. It is the first time in my life, and I was 25 at the time, that I saw a celebration related to Spain, the country, in the Basque country. That was the first time I saw something like that. And for me, it was something important because I saw for the first time that perhaps there was some more freedom of speech than I could have thought of.
Later, World Cup, a new coach, Vicente del Bosque, that's in his native Essex there, and a new feeling of confidence about the team, Alvaro.
Yeah, I think that Vicente del Bosque tried to bring his own ideas to the team. In fact, if you check the first list that he gave, there were some players and then they didn't come back. Albert Riera, Diego Capel, some players. Albert Riera played for Liverpool, in fact, as far as I remember. Yeah. So there were some players in there that Vicente del Bosque wanted to bring his own ideas. But he quickly realized that maybe the 4-4-2 wasn't going that well for the team. So the Villa and Torres thing was a partnership that we didn't see that often. And then there was a huge problem for him. Marco Senna was gone. But at the same time, there was a huge blessing for him that Pep Guardiola was in Barcelona. And I think that Vicente del Bosque knew very quickly that if he could bring and import Barcelona into the national team, he had a winning team in his hands.
It wasn't a great start for him, and Spain's progress through the competition, they didn't exactly blow the doors off, did they?
Für sich die Schweiz im Strafraum drin. Gelson Fernandes. Tor! Tor! Tor für die Schweiz!
The first game of the World Cup, they were, I mean, really poor against Switzerland. You know, sometimes you get these shock results first game of a tournament, but, you know, shocks can happen in football. But I was quite surprised. I remember watching this at how lacking penetration and lacking threat Spain were. They played Silva and Iniesta as the wide players coming inside. Xavi almost as the number 10. And it was almost like they had five players in the zone where really, compared to Barcelona, you know, they'd only have three there, and Barcelona would have, you know, wide players going in behind, stretching the play. Spain didn't really have that. And of course, they continued with the tiki-taka way with trying to keep possession. But thereafter, they always included a player who offered a bit more penetration, whether, you know, Fabregas coming off the bench or Jesus Navas played a big role in that World Cup. And it took a while, well, it took 2 years really before they went to playing, you know, two playmakers in the wide positions again.
Yeah, because this was a period of Busquets and Xabi Alonso in the same team. Too cautious, Alvaro?
I thought so. And many people in public and media thought so as well. But Vicente del Bosque, after the defeat against Switzerland, when the critics to Sergio Busquets were harsher than ever, he said something that, in a way, exonerated Busquets. He said, if I were a player again, I would like to be him. So I think that was the best way of killing off all the controversy or all the debate about Sergio Busquets. And losing against Switzerland was obviously something hard for Spain because there was this feeling that it was now or never in World Cup 2010. But then there were a couple of nervy games in the group stage that Spain managed to handle, but they were very difficult, both of them. And after that, there was a fresh start. Spain knew that they were on course to win the World Cup.
The semi-final, Michael, that's the bit that you focus on in the book. Why is that?
Yeah, it's interesting what Alvaro says about it's not always the final you remember. I mean, this was, you know, not a great final, as I'm sure we'll talk about in a second. But, I mean, Germany really were, in terms of getting to the best level, I think they were the best team in that tournament. They scored four against Australia, four against England, four against Argentina. They really looked like the side to beat, even if they weren't the outright favourites. But I think what you saw in this game was a complete clash of philosophy.
Xavi's corner. Puyol with a flying leap. Carlos Puyol scores for Spain.
The Spain are just more proactive. They can take the game to the opposition. Their pressing is much better than Germany's or anyone else's really in the competition. Germany at this stage are a pure counter-attacking side. And it's almost like they're just waiting. They're sitting back waiting for the concessions of possession and then go to counter as they did against England and Argentina. And one, Spain don't give them that opportunity. And two, after Puyol heads the winner, Spain just keep the ball. And Germany just aren't accustomed to pressing. They aren't accustomed to going looking for the ball. And then I think, you know, that leads to the development of German football 2 years later, and particularly 4 years later when they win it. You see that they've learned a lot from Spain. The players are always citing Spanish players as examples. Guardiola, of course, goes to Bayern and brings some, you know, different influences there. So this was, yeah, for me was almost the final in terms of the best two sides, and I think probably the best knockout game as well.
Well, particularly as the final was very much a knockout game in a very different way, in that the Dutch quite clearly decided that they weren't going to be able to match Spain on technique. So they decided to essentially kick lumps out of them until they stopped twitching.
Yeah, and the referee Howard Webb, he was very permissive when it came to bookings. But I believe that Spain knew how to handle that. And they didn't become hysteric, which could have happened considering it was a World Cup final. I remember the words of Andrés Iniesta just years after the World Cup, saying that he wasn't surprised with Mark Van Bommel being that hard, because they played together for a number of years, and Iniesta knew that Van Bommel was going to play that well. And of course, there is this kick from Nigel de Jong on Xabi Alonso's chest. I believe that if Xabi Alonso takes off his shirt now, you will still see the barbecue marks in there.
Bueno, por favor, por favor. Pero y hay que creerse que no le ha visto. Y hay que creerse que no le ha visto.
Es una barbaridad. Este es Howard Webb. Es el miedo que teníamos, que no puede permitir esta cosa.
Es increíble.
But Spain knew that the biggest threat in there was Arjen Robben. And Capdevila, one of those underrated players, was tremendously well surrounded by Busquets, Xabi Alonso, or Xabi. Just helping Capdevila with Robben in the one-on-ones. And I believe that Spain had the possession. Perhaps they didn't have the edge until the edge, and especially the sharpness until the final extra time. But overall, they were better. And all the players, I would say, that played monumentally, the Spanish players, especially, I believe that Iniesta was fantastic. And if you watch that game until the 115 minute, and you forget about Iniesta's goal, you will still say that Iniesta was the best player overall. That was when Iniesta scored. Everybody knew that that scoreline wasn't going to change, because Spain knew how to defend themselves with the ball.
So that's the European Championships in the bag. That's a World Cup in the bag. Only thing to go on is try and do it all over again. They got the first bit right, but again, with this Spanish team, even though it's a similar generation of players, it's a different sort of team, isn't it, Michael?
Yes, there's two big injury absences. One is Carlos Puyol, which means Ramos moving into the middle alongside Piqué. And the other, probably more significant, I would say, is David Villa is also out. 4 years before, they would bring in Torres. There'd be no problems there. Torres is kind of in his Chelsea phase, so isn't really looking sharp. So they start the tournament with Fabregas up front, which I gather was a surprise to the players. They hadn't really worked on that in training. And it was quite a late decision by Del Bosque to say, actually, we're going to play Fabregas as the false nine. And at this point, they've gone back to playing with Iniesta and Silva in the wide positions. So it's just three midfielders. There's no winger there. There's no forward there. It's a team of, you know, four defenders and six midfielders. And I think at this tournament, they go even further towards, you know, this almost complete possession dominance and just starve the opposition of the ball.
And of course, if you're part of football Twitter at this time in Twitter's development, there's a kind of schism between everyone who's watching football as to whether this Spain side are really, really good or really, really boring.
Well, I believe that they knew how to maximise what they had. Spain didn't score many goals. In fact, they did against Italy in the final, but during the tournament it was difficult for them to score. And I believe that that doesn't come from an idea. I mean, it wasn't a Spanish idea, the Spanish idea not to score. It was, in fact, an inability to score goals. It wasn't a catenaccio, per se, not at all. But there was no Villa. Fernando Torres wasn't in a good shape, even though he scored 3 goals in that competition, but he wasn't in a good shape. And Fernando Llorente was absolutely knackered because he had played the season under Marcelo Bielsa. And I was talking to Fernando Llorente back at the time in the pre-season in Austria, and he couldn't even move. And Javi Martínez either, both Athletic de Bilbao players. So there was a hint that Spain could play with a 4-6-0 formation because Barcelona had won the Club World Cup 6 months before with that formation. But of course, Barcelona had Messi, and Spain didn't have anyone who could look like a midfielder but score goals like a striker. So as the tournament progressed, they became much more clever. They knew how to use their resources, and some other teams like France, for example, or like Portugal, they were very good as well, but they didn't have that extra thing that you need in the extra moments. And in Spain, I think that in that Euro Cup in particular, it was Iker Casillas.
They beat France 2-0, 2 goals from Xabi Alonso. They scraped through on penalties against Portugal in the semi. There's a Spanish team winning on penalties, so it's generally a positive thing. And then comes a final against Italy. They go back to playing without a striker. And I've got to admit, when this game kicked off, it was, OK, you've got a possession-heavy, to be diplomatic, Spanish team against Italy. Not going to be many goals in this one.
Yeah, so Fabregas came back in up front. They tried a bit of Torres, they tried Negredo, and as Alvaro says, Llorente wasn't really an option. But the interesting thing about this is, if you look at kind of heat maps or touch maps between the two games against Italy, which bookended Spain's competition, Fabregas is playing up front in both of them. But the first game, he basically plays as an extra midfielder. He's always coming deep, he's always coming to, you know, getting the ball to feet. In the final, he's playing basically as a striker. He's going in behind the defence, he's stretching the play. And I think that brings another dimension to the way Spain play. And they were really threatening in the first 20 minutes, and they go ahead through a brilliant goal with the three forwards, if you like, combining Iniesta, Fabregas and Silva with a header. And that's the kind of goal. I don't think they were really threatening to score that kind of goal at certain stages of the tournament before that, because they weren't offering that movement in behind. And this was, just an incredible first half performance.
Fabregas darts forward around the outside of Chiellini, who tried to hold him up. The ball's in. David Silva has struck gold for Spain.
4-0 it ends up. And Spain are there. European Championships, done. World Cup, done. European Championships retained, done. World Cup in 2014. What happened?
Well, I think that Vicente del Bosque wanted to be very loyal to the team that gave him 2 titles back to back. And perhaps he should have applied a couple of changes to that national team. In fact, there is a story that at some point Vicente del Bosque got very angry in the way to World Cup 2014. He didn't like the way that some veteran players were training. And he pointed at Koke in the locker room, and Atletico de Madrid youngster at the time, and he pointed at him and he said, "This guy has the hunger and the attitude, but you have lost it." And there is this story that probably is true, that some of the players didn't treat the national team with the same level of interest as before. It's multifactorial, obviously. Barcelona and Real Madrid have had many problems in La Liga. Many players, Casillas, Xavi, Iniesta, Arbeloa, they weren't in good terms, or they hadn't been in good terms and they had fixed the relationship. But obviously, Spain wasn't the fresh team that was in 2008 anymore. And I believe that the revolution in the Spanish team, if not revolution, the evolution of the Spanish national team should have gone a bit sooner, probably in 2014 rather than in 2016.
Michael, what's the legacy of this Spanish team?
Well, I think of all the sides we've discussed in this series, it's the most obvious legacy. They really did inspire everyone to start playing possession football, whether that was their natural style or not. We saw that particularly with the German side, who became more proactive. Even in English football, and we weren't blessed with the technical quality of Spain, but there's still a kind of this desperation that we've got to start dominating the ball, because that's the kind of style that wins games. So you almost can't separate the legacy of this Spain side and the legacy of Guardiola's Barcelona side. But for that 4-year period, it's just complete dominance. Unlike, I think, anything I've known in my time following football, where this is just the way to play.
Well, if you want to read about that period of time and about all the other periods of time in the last 20, 25 years of European football, you know what you need to pick up, don't you? That is all we've got time for this week. Thank you, Michael and Alvaro. The book, Zonal Marking, is out now. It's in hardback, ebook, audiobook. You'll find it all over the place. It's really, really good. Buy it right now. Join us next time for our final episode. We'll be joined by Rafa Honigstein to discuss Bayern's treble success in 2013.